Well, good morning. Good morning. We're just on time, so that's a great sign. I have no guarantees about when we'll finish, because when I gave this series at Covenant Fellowship in the fall, and the Sunday school hour is 1 hour instead of 45 minutes, and there's nothing after the Sunday school hour, so it didn't matter how long I went. I will try to observe the 45 minutes, but for an old college professor who's used to a 55-minute class hour, 45 minutes is tough. The subjects of slavery and racism have been very much in the news in recent months, with riots or violence in countless cities. People want to know where the RP Church comes down on these issues. Now, I'm happy to tell you about the experiences of RPs in our country's sad history of slavery and racism. I've called this series A Candle Against the Darkness. You've no doubt heard a popular saying, it's better to light a single candle than to curse the darkness. The witness of the Reformed Presbyterian Church was one of the first points of light shining in the darkness of the slavery era. I think our title pretty well sums up the attitude of a small but very determined people known as Reformed Presbyterians, nicknamed Covenanters. This study is scheduled for 6 weeks, and this is the tentative plan for it. I'll try to move this over. Can you all see now? See the screen? Subject to adjustments as needed, we'll be talking about the Reformed Presbyterian background and the existence of slavery in America. Next week, the early anti-slavery movement. Third, RP anti-slavery doctrine, because this was more than just activism. This was based on doctrine. The Covenanters and the Underground Railroad, the approaching storm, the years immediately leading up to the Civil War, and the involvement of RPs there. And finally, the Covenanters in the Civil War. And the war came, a quotation from Lincoln's second inaugural. Why, you might ask, do the actions and publications of Reformed Presbyterians matter? Let me suggest there are six reasons, and the handout that you have, I should say, is the material that's on the screen, but there's room to take notes on the page if you wish. There will be a quiz afterwards. Reformed Presbyterians were the first church to enforce an absolute prohibition against slaveholders in the church. There were churches, as we'll see, that passed resolutions against slavery before that, but never put any teeth to it, really. RPs, once our presbytery decided to prohibit slavery, immediately put it into force, and no compromise and no looking back. RPs were among the founders and leaders of anti-slavery organizations, which came to have a large role in the anti-slavery movement. Yes, the changing the attitude of society as a whole. RPs were centers of activity for the Underground Railway. Were the first Presbyterian body to establish a mission for education and the charitable relief for the freedmen. Our theological seminary, RPTS, had a racially integrated student body in the 1840s in Cincinnati, and that was radical at that point. And Geneva College, founded in 1848, in Ohio, was a hotbed of Underground Railroad activity, of volunteers for the Union cause, and an early leader in providing post-secondary education to former slaves. I've been fortunate to draw on a number of published and unpublished resources for this. I want to tell you about just a few of them. The first is a master's thesis by D. Ray Wilcox, who taught Greek and Bible and various other subjects at Geneva for 20 years in the 50s and 60s, and I think into 73. The Reformed Presbyterian Church and the Anti-Slavery Movement, unpublished thesis from the Colorado State College of Education at Greeley. And that has never been published, but there are copies of it in both the seminary library and in McCartney Library at Geneva College. Kennedy, Andrew Todd Kennedy, A Stump for My Pillow, The Civil War, 1861 to 64. This is unpublished. I believe there's a copy of it in the seminary. It is not in McCartney Library. We're working to try to get it cleaned up and get it published in some form. But Kennedy was an RP from Southern Illinois who served in the Army and kept a diary and letters home and so on. He was captured and was 9 months in Libby prison in Richmond, and then repatriated. It's very interesting reading, one of many, many diaries and memoirs of soldiers from the war. And the white book here indicates RPTS Library, McCartney Library, even though, as I say, I know this is not in McCartney Library, and I'm not sure whether it's in the seminary library. Swisshelm, James Gray Cannon Swisshelm, was born to an RP family in Pittsburgh and became a leader in a number of causes, the anti-slavery movement, public safety. She was a nurse, acting nurse during the Civil War in Washington. She worked in a government office for a while. She was one of the first female journalists in the country. She was the first female journalist to sit in the press gallery in the United States Senate. And, you know, really a very interesting life. And I really recommend that. Samuel Brown Wiley, Memoir of Alexander McLeod, D.D., which is in the seminary library. Oops, what did I do there? Yes, it's in the seminary library, and I believe also in McCartney Library. Then there's a new book out, 2016, Joseph S. Moore, Founding Sins, How a Group of Anti-Slavery Radicals Fought to Put Christ into the Constitution. And that's in the RPTS Library and McCartney Library. The last time I checked, it was not yet in the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh. There's a bit of a controversy about that. Joseph Moore teaches at a college in South Carolina, and how can I put it? A number of RPs who have read it are mad about it. I think maybe their anger is a little bit misplaced, but Joseph Moore misunderstands the RPs. He talks about the ARPs and the New Lights and the Presbyterians and so on, the Free Presbyterians, but he doesn't understand the RPs. And he basically ends up saying that it's because of the RPs that the United States has preserved this rigid wall between church and state. Now, how he gets to that is another story. It's interesting reading anyway. But it's a scholarly, historical work. The abolition of slavery required a bigger network. A group of, at best, a few thousand people couldn't by themselves bring about a major social transformation. The movement to abolish slavery in the United States was a network of people and institutions, what we might call the center and the periphery. The center would include the founding fathers and their heirs, who, while many of them owned slaves, were opposed to slavery, did not approve of it. The centers of education and thought, Harvard, Yale, and the more prestigious theological seminaries, all were part of the center, the core of the anti-slavery movement. Then on the periphery, we have individuals and groups with activist mindsets, Christian churches, especially some of the smaller denominations, including our own, and made effective use of communication technology. Now, in those days, what was communication technology? They didn't have computers and so on, but the printing press was high-tech communication at the time, and they made effective use of that in newspapers, magazines, tracts and pamphlets, letters to the editor, and so on. Why were RPs so active in the anti-slavery movement? The sociologist Max Weber tried long ago to classify churches. First, he said not all churches believe in salvation. For example, those who believe that at death we simply cease to be, or that we come back as spirits or as somebody else. Among those religions which believe in salvation, he saw two types, which he labeled ascetic and mystical. Reformed Presbyterians fall into the ascetic side. They reject the world as it is, that is, sinful, work to transform the world into a vision of God's will, do not flee from the world, but work within the world for Christ, seek to triumph over the temptations of the world. And Weber gave his examples of Congregationalists, Episcopalians, Presbyterians, and Quaker churches. The other type that he identifies as mystical, he says, focus on achieving rest in God. As a result, they accept the secular social structure at hand. They focus almost exclusively on their own salvation. Churches such as the Baptist, Mennonite, Methodist, and Moravian churches would fall into this category. And as a matter of fact, we find that these denominations were much less active in the anti-slavery movement than the other churches we looked at a minute ago, the Congregational, Episcopal, Presbyterian, and Quakers. The Quakers and Presbyterians in particular, and in New England, the Congregationalists. Reformed Presbyterians, as a part of our vision of a society transformed for Jesus Christ, have been activists throughout our more than three centuries. In the 16th and 17th centuries, this took the form of fighting for the independence of the church from the state, insisting that the church and the state are separate, but are equally obligated to obey Christian principles. And this, of course, was the point of the persecution that we endured during the Stuart monarchies. In the 19th century, in America, this included social action, such as the National Reform Association, which some of you may be familiar with. It still exists. The anti-slavery and temperance movements, programs for the poor, the sick, and the freed slaves. RPs have always had a particular take on the unity of mankind. The words you see on the screen, "Ye are God's creatures, created and formed to his image and similitude. In the hope of the life to come, he hath made all equal." Now, it sounds like it might have been written by Thomas Jefferson or one of his friends, doesn't it? But it was written actually in 1558, a couple of centuries before Thomas Jefferson, written by John Knox in a publication called A Letter Addressed to the Commonalty of Scotland. The big difference is that when Jefferson wrote, "All men are created equal," he didn't mean all equal, all people, but he meant all white male people. John Knox intended to include all people. And genuinely reformed people have always insisted that racism is sinful. Knox, who's often referred to as the father of the Scottish Reformation, wrote those words, and in the same letter urged the Protestants in Scotland to participate actively in reforming their nation. "It will not excuse you, dear brethren, in the presence of God, neither yet will it avail you in the day of his visitation to say, we were but simple subjects, we could not redress the faults and crimes of our rulers, bishops, and clergy." He was challenging us not to make excuses about it, but to go ahead and do something. It'll be helpful to review briefly the experiences of Reformed Presbyterians during the Reformation period. The distinguishing feature of the Scottish Reformation is the bond or covenant by which people bound themselves together. By an old Scottish usage, a covenant was the basis for ordinary confederations, in which the confederates promised to assist each other in the work proposed and to protect each other from the consequences. The covenants were drawn up in legal style and sworn before public notaries. At the time of the Reformation, those who covenanted now made public promise to God to be faithful to his word. These religious covenants began in 1557 and were renewed and enlarged time after time during the next century and more. At their coronations, the later Stuart monarchs swore to honor and abide by these covenants, a vow which all of them broke as soon as convenient. As the kings became more persistent in asserting their right to govern a church and determine its doctrines, the covenanters dug their heels in. Many would not give in and were driven from their homes. An estimated 18,000 people in Scotland suffered under the royal persecution, suffering which long remained in the memories of the covenanters. They could be arrested, imprisoned, tortured, and executed. Toward the end of the period, any soldier who was authorized to shoot on the spot, any man, woman, or child who refused to swear an oath of allegiance to the king as supreme. So this period, from the restoration of Charles II in 1660, that's the end of the Cromwellian Commonwealth, to the overthrow of James II in 1688, was remembered as the killing time. During the killing time, faithful covenanters met secretly for prayer and the preaching of the gospel. They formed praying societies or society meetings and so maintained their identity. They also held conventicles in the mountains or in remote spots in the country or wherever they could, where they were less likely to be discovered for larger gatherings, and it was these times when the Lord's Supper was dispensed. They had a warm evangelical faith, which is expressed in the writings and sermons of the time. And we'll talk in a few minutes about a little bit more about the society meetings. Because the leading spirit of the last years of this period was the Reverend Richard Cameron, these society people came to be referred to as Cameronians, the most conservative of the covenanting movement. And you notice names like Richard Cameron and John Knox still crop up very frequently in RP families, naming their sons after these early leaders. One cannot understand the history of the Reformed Presbyterian Church unless one realizes the deep combination of personal piety and political responsibility that animated the Covenanter martyrs. Their scaffold testimonies and their letters, such as those of Samuel Rutherford, Rutherford is another familiar name in RP families, were reprinted generation after generation, and children were told these stories from earliest childhood. One example will suffice. Jane Cannon Swisshelm, whom I mentioned a few minutes ago, born to a Covenanter family in Pittsburgh in 1815, described the efforts of her Methodist husband, and why she ever married a Methodist, I'm not sure, and his family to break her of her Calvinism. But, she said, they found a subject that would not run. My kith and kin had died at the stake, bearing testimony against popery and prelacy, had fought on those fields where Scotsmen had charged in solid columns, singing psalms. And though I was wax at all other points, I was granite on the solemn league and covenant. Not only was Christ the head of the church, but likewise prince of the kingdoms of the earth. In America, oh, I should say, too, these praying societies, the prayer meetings, society meetings, were, in effect, cell groups. You know, the church in the last half century or less, as a whole, the Protestant church has rediscovered fellowship groups and home Bible studies. Well, we were at it long before the late 20th century. Okay, in America, many of these Cameronians continued to have their society meetings, even when no ministers were available. These societies comprised two or more families living in one community. They would meet in a home for worship, Bible study, the reading of accepted authors, and the like, as they had been accustomed to. It doesn't take much to foul up this little button. So this practice of society meetings continued into this country. They admitted and disciplined members, but they did not observe baptism or communion when there was no minister. A presbytery was organized in 1774, but lasted only until 1782, and into an abortive union. I say abortive because we'll see in a minute what happened there. Here are just a few of the RP leaders who established the pattern of resistance to the British government in the colonies. Alexander Craighead, who led in a renewal of the Solemn League and Covenant in 1743, its 100th anniversary. John Cuthbertson came in 1751 and spent his life as an itinerant, visiting all of the scattered societies of RPs, made one trip out to the Wild West, as far as Allegheny County, to a community on the Youghiogheny River near what's now Elizabeth, PA. William Martin, who worked in South Carolina, he arrived in 1772 and brought with him five shiploads of people from Northern Ireland. Now, they weren't all RPs, but they were all Presbyterians of one sort or another that came at once and settled in Chester County, or the region of what's now Chester County. Matthew Lynn, who came to Pennsylvania in 1773, and Alexander Dobbin, who came at the same time and settled in Gettysburg. And this house, if any of you have been to Gettysburg, and I assume most everybody has at one point or another, this is on the main drag from the town square out to the battlefield. He built that house and established the first classical school west of the Allegheny Mountains. The house was used as a hospital during the battle, and it's now a very nice restaurant. In the basement. You want to find the best eats in Gettysburg, go to the Dobbin House. Dobbin House, yes. From the very birth. Oh, no, before I get to that, the earliest covenanters to come to America were prisoners, shipped to the colonies as political prisoners. Punishment? Yes, they were shipped to New Jersey. By the 18th century, many Scotsmen had immigrated to North Ireland and to America and continued their resistance to what they believed was wrong about the British government. From the very birth of the U.S. Constitution in 1789, the Reformed Presbyterians objected to its flaws. First, they said it failed to acknowledge God or Christ as the source of the nation's liberty. Second, it protected human slavery. And third, it even gave slavery preferential treatment through what's called the three-fifths rule. Now, that was the rule by which, well, it was a compromise between the southern states and the northern states when the Constitution was written. The southern states wouldn't accept the Constitution without something like this. They wanted all of their slaves to count in the population in terms of the Electoral College and the House of Representatives. The northerners said, no, those are not free people, they're not voters, so they can't count. So the compromise was that the southern states could count three-fifths of their slave population toward the population for purposes of representation and the Electoral College. So it put a thumb in the scale. That meant that the South was overrepresented in national politics. One of their early actions, the RP's early actions, was to authorize a testimony which included the statement, since the adoption of the Constitution in the year 1789, the members of the Reformed Presbyterian Church have refused to serve in any office which implies an approbation of the Constitution or which is placed under the direction of an immoral law. They have abstained from giving their votes at elections for legislators or officers who must be qualified to act by any oath of allegiance to this immoral system. And many of us who are older remember when RPs not only did not vote or run for public office, but were not allowed to become postmasters. There was a time when we refused to serve on juries, a lot of things to try to be consistent in rejecting anything that promised submission to an immoral constitution. Two of their three objections to the Constitution became widespread among abolitionists some years later. That the document authorizes and protects slavery, in other words, that it's a pro-slavery document, and the three-fifths rule was anti-democratic. In the early 1840s, many abolitionists began. Like the Covenanters, however, William Lloyd Garrison, probably the most famous abolitionist, condemned the Constitution as utterly pro-slavery and so thoroughly controlled by slaveholders that sincere abolitionists should not vote in any political elections at all. Garrison described the Constitution in the words of the prophet Isaiah as a covenant with death and an agreement with hell. He said that in a 4th of July speech. So it was very much in your face. As events unfolded from 1789 to 1866, the Covenanters' analysis of the Constitution in its relation to slavery eventually became the view of the country as a whole. The Covenanters' attitude of dissent from both ecclesiastical and civil governments, whether in Scotland or America, which do not conform to the standards of Scripture, is that basic principle of the Reformed Presbyterians which must be understood if we are to discover the driving force behind their work opposing slavery and racism. Their objections to the new Constitution of the United States were parallel. It violated the rights of both God and man. Their immediate protest, complete and uncompromising, of harsh experience against. Let's look at the origins and nature of American slavery. Slavery is an ancient institution. From antiquity, people who lost wars or raids and their wives and children were routinely subjected to involuntary servitude. Hugh Thomas, the historian of the Atlantic slave trade, wrote, "Most settled societies at one time or another have employed forced labor, and most peoples have experienced years of servitude. Slavery played a major role in the economic and social life of ancient Assyria, Egypt, Babylon, Greece, and Rome. In Northern Europe, it slowly evolved into serfdom, but in the Mediterranean and Muslim worlds, it continued in its traditional forms for many centuries. Indeed, it was not abolished in law in Saudi Arabia until 1962, and exists today de facto in various places. Central Africa, be it Kurdistan, Pakistan, Ada dominates. Last year, the United States was very much a continuing problem, and that includes people in the United States, for example, who are held in sexual servitude. It's an ongoing problem around the world. Now, black slaves had been known in the late Middle Ages in Europe, but these were brought via land routes by Muslim traders. By the beginning of the late 13th century, Europeans began to explore the west coast of Africa, trading for gold, ivory, and other commodities, including slaves. In the 1600s, the Portuguese, who dominated this trade, were introducing African slaves into Iberia, that is, Spain and Portugal. I've gone backwards again, haven't I? Somebody should wave a red flag at me when I do that. She promises, okay. you see, the end of the 15th century, that's the 1490s, that's shortly after Columbus discovered the Americas. The Portuguese introduced black slaves into Iberia, that is Spain and Portugal. And in the 1600s, the Portuguese, who dominated this trade at that point, developed a plan to send... I'm sorry, I've lost my place here. We're introducing African slaves into Iberia. Christopher Columbus, on his second voyage to the New World in 1493, developed a plan to send Native Americans to Spain as slaves. But Queen Isabella refused her permission. The first industry established by Europeans in the New World was raising sugarcane, which requires a large labor force, and the Indians did not thrive under the conditions created by their new masters. They died off at a fearful rate. Around 1500, African slaves began to be introduced into Hispaniola, which is now divided between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. The first deluge of cattle to the Western Hemisphere in the next three African slaves to be brought out as now the United States arrived in Jamestown, Virginia in 1619 aboard two English pirate ships. These slaves had been purchased in Angola by the Portuguese, and that ship had been captured by the English pirates. In the English colonies, however, there was no law concerning slavery, and the earliest bonded laborers, whether African or European, were treated as indentured servants. That is, their servitude ended after a specified length of time, at which they were considered to have worked off the costs of bringing them to the colony. If you were an impoverished Scotsman, for instance, you could sign yourself up to be an indentured servant, so that somebody else would pay the cost of your transportation to the New World, and then you were obliged to work for him for so many years. 7 years was a common extent of that. A few other Negroes seem to have come from England as slaves of English nobles who acquired property in Virginia. Beginning with James I in 1603, and he was James the sixth of Scotland and the first of England, but since we want to put in some digs about the English, we'll call him James I. The English monarchs licensed and encouraged the traffic in slaves, and throughout the 17th century, the English share of that trade increased. The great need for labor in the colonies of the vast new continents and the existing practice of slavery among the Native Americans were two strong temptations for the Christian conquerors, and they quickly adopted this expedient. In Latin America, in spite of the mildness of Spanish legislation compared with the black codes of other nations, the treatment of slaves was often barbarous. Plantation owners debated whether it was more economical to drive the slaves to fatigue and death and to replace them often, or to save their strength by shorter hours and somewhat less arduous toil. The death rate of Negro slaves in Latin America was substantially higher than in the southern United States. But of course, the climate of the U.S. South is much more temperate than the Caribbean, and home to fewer deadly diseases and deadly snakes, I might add. The slave population of the United States, in contrast to Latin America, grew primarily through natural increase, and after 1808, it was almost exclusively natural increase. And you can see some figures here. I'm sorry, some of these slides do have far too much type on them, but I work to get the slides smaller and the type bigger. In 1671, there were 2,000 Negro slaves in Virginia and 6,000 white indentured servants. By 1700, 30 years later, the Negro population of Virginia was 16,000. By 1800, it was 347,000, which gives you an idea. That's a combination of natural increase and in the importation of new slaves. By 1825, in the southern states as a whole, not just Virginia, but the whole South, the slave population was 1,750,000 people. And here again, this is probably the most illegible slide in the series. By 1860, there were 4 million slaves in the southern states. The white population of the region was approximately 8.3 million. And so that means that about 32.5% of the total population of the South were slaves. They had a market value somewhere between $3.1 and $3.6 billion. So the South had a great deal of money invested in their slaves. Out of the total population of the South, of about 8.3 million, there were only about 400,000 slave owners. And we have...
A quick question with the value. Is that $1,860 or is that just the location?
$60, yeah. We often have the impression that most slaves worked in these large plantations. That's not the case. There were only 22 owners in the whole South who held over 500 slaves apiece. There were 2,341 owners who had between 100 and 500 slaves. 200,000 owners possessed from one to five slaves each. So the typical slave experience was of being on a very small, it might be one slave working for a farmer or two slaves working for the same farmer, something like that. Now the others, those statistics don't add up, but you see this doesn't include people who held between 5 and 100 slaves, or What is it? I guess that's it. So there's a big missing out of the statistics. I go by what I can find in the records. Slave owners who were about 2.5% of the South, that is 400,000 out of 8.3 million, ruled the South and often the nation, which was 31.4 million people in 1860. So, to boil it down, one-third of the population controlled the country. The country could not do anything. Congress could not pass legislation without the support of the South. And so those slave owners, and in particular the 22 who owned over 500 slaves, controlled the country. Dean?
Bob, what do we Jefferson
would come in, I think, between 100 and 500. And I'm not sure about Washington. I think he had fewer than 100, but I could be wrong about that. Now, this growth in slavery was not confined to the South. Slaves were introduced into Massachusetts and New York with the earliest settlers. Vessels were fitted out for the slave trade in northern ports. Every colony had some slaves. There was sentiment in all of the colonies against slavery, and various attempts were made to prohibit the traffic. In 1772, Virginia legislature, the Virginia legislature asked King George III to stop the importation of slaves into that colony, but the request was denied. Denied primarily because of money out of the slave trade. Soon after the Revolutionary War, various states outlawed slavery. In 1780, Massachusetts adopted a new constitution and abolished slavery, but that was not effective until 1783. So there was a three-year gap in preparing for the new constitution. Also in 1780, Pennsylvania provided a gradual emancipation. Now, what gradual emancipation here and in other colonies meant was that people, adults who were enslaved, stayed that way. Their children who were born into slavery worked until a certain age, when it was considered they had worked off the cost of their upbringing, and then they were free. In some cases it was 21, 25 for females, 31 for males. So that's, we think about gradual emancipation, what can that mean? Well, that's what the term means. In 1794, New York followed suit. Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North and South Carolina, and Georgia continued to maintain the institution of slavery. When slaves in northern colonies were freed, many owners sold their slaves to the South. So the North could not claim innocence when discussing the origin and early history of slavery. But it was in the South that the institution took root and grew until it was an indispensable part of the economy and the basis for political life. The slave population, well, let's see, I got ahead of myself on that. Mentioning the large slave owners, I should mention that the 22 people that owned more than 500 slaves, the famous Confederate cavalry general Wade Hampton III was popularly known as the wealthiest man in the South. He's said to have owned over 20,000 acres of land, and his father, Wade Hampton II, had owned 3,000 slaves. That's an amazing number. A slave's quality of life varied according to his or her owner and overseer and to the geographical location. Plantations along the south, which raised rice and indigo, which is primarily northeast Georgia and southeast South Carolina and coastal Louisiana, organized slaves by the task system, under which each slave was assigned a task to accomplish each day. And when the task was completed, he or she was free to use the rest of their time as they wished. The pattern of organization of slave labor in the uplands, where tobacco and cotton were the principal crops, was the gang method, in which a group of slaves would be directed to labor together and were usually kept in the fields from sunup to sundown. So they had much less opportunity and energy for self-improvement. Frederick Douglass, a slave who managed to escape and became an articulate spokesman and writer for abolition, wrote, "The whole trend and tenor of the slave codes rested upon the well-grounded belief that the normal frame of mind of the Negro was a desire for freedom. And this belief is supported by the countless instances of fugitives who had no better reason to give for running away than that obstinate desire to be free, which the white people counted among their chief claims to the admiration of mankind." Slaves were often treated with great cruelty. Not always. Some slave owners took care of their slaves as property, more or less as farmers today try to take good care of their cattle and hogs. And treated them generously, in fact, allowed them to accumulate enough private capital to buy their own freedom or to buy the freedom of their wife and children. But not all of them. Many of the slaves were treated with great cruelty. Each state's legislature enacted a slave code to control the slaves. Some laws protected them from excessive abuse. Their lives, for example, were theoretically protected. All slaveholding states made the malicious and unnecessary killing of a slave a capital offense, but the master was allowed to exercise authority sufficient to protect his life and enforce his commands. The Tennessee law of 1836 specifically held that, and I quote, "Any slave dying under moderate correction could not be held to be..." The definition of moderate, of course, was the crux of the matter. So Covenanters, like millions of others in the North, were revolted by the cruelty visited on the slaves and their owners and overseers. But regardless of the quality of life of slaves, the efforts of the Reformed Presbyterians would have been little different, because their primary objection was not to the treatment of slaves, because we recognize that cruelty is an inherent part of slavery. You can't have slavery without cruelty. Okay, so we went after the root cause of that. The objection was to the very existence of slavery. Well, next week we'll talk about the early anti-slavery movement in the United States. And I see I'm a little past time, but I hope you'll forgive that. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week, Lord willing.